It's Jim, it's the World of Bonds. It's Wednesday, 27th of March, 2024. This is for professional investors only. Never ever investment advice. So as I said before, this might well be the last episode of Uncle Jim's World of Bonds for this season. We'll see what happens next couple of days, but otherwise, this is it. Enjoy your Easter break. So we start the end of Wednesday with the sad news, the death of Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. You've all probably read his books, Thinking Fast and Slow and so forth. He was the Israeli-American professor who became really famous in the past three decades, really, having put to bed some of the really core ideas of classical and neoclassical economics. That is that human beings are what's called homo economicus, economic man, woman, that we're all entirely rational in what we do. And, lots of economics and market theories like the efficient markets hypothesis based on these views that we're rational and have all the information and that our emotions play no part in what we do. In terms of investing or deciding about other economic activity that we engage in. Anyway, he died. Very interesting and fascinating life, and I'm sure there'll be lots of obituaries for him in tomorrow's newspapers, so please take a read of those. But basically, he found that human beings relied heavily on heuristics. Heuristics are very, very useful to human beings. So they tell you that if you're in the jungle and you see rustling in the trees and a flash of orange, it might well be a tiger. So, rules of thumb, rustling plus orange is a tiger is really, really useful to you. But other heuristics are not so useful to you, and those shortcuts that we take in investing and so forth cause us to make assumptions, to be overconfident, and so forth. And in 2011 he wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, and there's lots of these ideas here. He linked up with a famous psychologist in Israel as well and states to build these theories that were built on by other people like Thaler and the nudge theory and so forth. Found that human beings were overconfident, and also they find, quote, cognitive effort mildly unpleasant and avoid us as much as possible. So amen to that. Came up with loss aversion theory, which was the idea that investors and other people, when you decide on careers and so forth, make the pain of loss more powerful to you in your head than the pleasure of winning, and that's an important part of investment decision making. So I would say that this discipline, sort of psychological behavioral economics, has come into under a bit of question over the past decade or so, with a number of the big proponents of it under investigation, I would say, in terms of how they've used their data set. Remember, this is not as simple as measuring stuff in test tubes. It's experiments generally with undergraduate students, with incentives of $1 bills and free pizzas and stuff like that. And that, but that's translated into real world economics and real world policies. And a lot of people have been quite critical about the unrepeatability of some of these studies. But I don't think you can argue with the interest and broad concepts that we're not purely rational in what we do being really important concepts if we think about markets and so forth. So sad news then. Going to quickly also mention the stats that came out this week from France, where we've got really quite big French budget deficits coming through. And we looked at US budget deficits in recent podcasts and seeing that's heading up towards 6-7%. Well, the French one came in well above forecasts at 5.5% for 2023 and likely to be around 5% this year. Both of them above where the government had forecast there'd be. So more government bonds coming. And I see Larry Fink of BlackRock has got his annual letter to shareholders out this morning. And the amount of government debt in the world is obviously something that's getting a lot of attention and is focused on in his letter as well. And it's something we will come back to time and time again. But today, to finish up this season, I think we're going to talk about India a bit and do a little bit of an India special. And the reason that I'm interested in India at the moment, and lots of people are, is that India is the last major emerging market economy to not be in the major emerging market bond indices, let alone the kind of global world government bond indices, like in the olden days it'd be Salomon Brothers Wigbe, today it's the Bloomberg aggregate indices or whatever it might be, but it's not even in the emerging market indices. So that's going to change in June. So in June, JP Morgan are putting it in the GBI, the global bond index for emerging markets, GBIEM. Bloomberg is also going to add it to its emerging market indices. Doesn't happen all in one go, so you're not going to see $1.2 trillion worth of Indian government bonds in the indices on one go. Maybe a third of it will enter in a gradual way, but that should provoke significant inflows. You know, a lot of index tracking nowadays in bond markets, just as there is in equity markets. So on the kind of 10% weighting in global emerging market bond indices, that could result in inflows totaling, I've seen estimates, $25 billion worth, $40 billion worth, but a run rate of $2 billion a month going into Indian government bonds for the foreseeable future come June time. Now, it must be said, this is not the easiest bond market in the world to invest in. It's administratively very, very difficult. There are tax issues, settlement issues, all of those things that you get in less developed bond markets, I would say. So it's going to be difficult for all that money to enter in, and people have to set up systems and so forth to allow them to trade it. But I think we're seeing in the marketplace generally strong demand for things like supranationals. These are AAA institutions like IBRD, EIB, etc., World Bank, who issue bonds with high credit ratings, and they can issue bonds based in India that get around some of these tax and settlement issues. So they've been pretty popular in the recent past few months ahead of this. So, we saw the result of China going into the global bond index, let alone the emerging market index, with a weighting of maybe 5-6%, and it does supply of indices weighting does create demand for investors, so this could be quite significant. So it's worth having a look at some of the economics of India, and a lot of what I'm going to say today comes from a really good note from Barclays on India and its economic case at the moment. It's by, well, the foreword at least is by Rahul Bajoria of Barclays. So if you've got access to it, dig that out. I can't send it to you, I'm afraid. So apologies in advance for that. But a good note. And basically, the note suggests that India could become the biggest contributor to global GDP growth within the next 5 years. So at the moment, well, for 2023, India probably grew at around 8%. Trend recently has been more like 6% and a bit. So if the 8% growth rate were to persist, then in the next 5 years, India's contribution to global growth could be the same as China's contribution to the global growth rate. So for most of the century, China has been the most important contributor to global growth. That could change within the next 5 years or so, and that would give India a 20% share of global GDP. So 8% growth, Barclays do think that's nearly sustainable, but might not be. Certainly 6% plus is sustainable, but there are risks of imbalances causing some instability, overheating, bubbles and things like that. In order to get above 6% towards 8%, they have to rely on some help from the demographics, some stable inflation. But they do have things going for them, including very clean private sector balance sheets and a high level of foreign reserves. But there are some risks too, and just to focus on a few of those, I'd point out, or rather Barclays point out, one is just the external global economy. If that's weak, India's going to be weak and not be able to grow as much. Commodity prices and energy imports would be a problem for India, and obviously geopolitics, having living in what has been described as a dangerous neighbourhood, Pakistan, one border, turbulence in Sri Lanka, some tensions with China on other borders. Big risk is policy complacency. You know, things are going well. Could governments take the eye off the ball and just assume that everything's okay? Public debt is growing, although GDP growth is higher than the interest rate that India is paying on its debt. So I don't think that's regarded as a biggie. But, you know, as Barclays point out, the household and corporate indebtedness is well under control. So it's not a generalized problem with debt. It's more government debt could carry on going up, and that might be an issue. And then there's electoral risk, and we have those big elections in April and May. You know, huge amount, one of the biggest populations in the world, the biggest population in the world, as we'll talk about in a second, going to the polls. And is there some key man risk around Modi? And how much of this growth, economic success, can you put down to Modi is another question. But I think he's still expected to win, and therefore the economic growth is expected to continue where we are. So what could India do to, you know, consistently get that growth rate up from 6 to 8 and above? Well, they'll need to see an increase in the working age population. A lot of that happens automatically just because of demographics. So the working age population goes up from 972 million now to over a billion by the end of this decade. Female participation rate is rising. It's around about 37%. Some people expect, you know, you could see a 5% increase in that, which would also deliver some high levels of GDP growth. And then within the demographics, you also need to rotate out of low productivity, generally agricultural jobs, and into the medium and higher skilled areas of the workforce. Also, I think that there's a kind of fear that there's not enough manufacturing in India. You know, there are agricultural jobs and there are service sector jobs, and some of those are very high value jobs, STEM related jobs, tech related jobs, but there are these call center jobs and so forth that perhaps don't have as long and impactful growth as developing a manufacturing sector like China did. That, you know, and there is talk of friendshoring, the fact that India, like other areas like Vietnam, for instance, might benefit from tariffs on and tensions between the West and China that allows India to take away from China some of those manufacturing jobs, and that could help its export growth. You know, it probably needs to double its export growth from 2%. 2.5% of global exports to something more than that in order to hit an 8% growth rate on a more meaningful, sustained level. But India has come a very, very long way economically. Let's not forget that Morgan Stanley in 2013 had India down in what it called its Fragile Five, alongside Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa and Turkey. And this was kind of a counterpoint to the Goldman Sachs BRICS idea. The Fragile Five were emerging market economies where there was a big reliance on foreign holders of debt, high levels of dollar denominated debt, high levels of inflation, current account deficits and so forth. So these were the emerging market economies thought to be most at risk of getting into difficulties. Morgan Stanley did take India off that list in 2017. And I think it was always in one of the better positions than those other four names. And, you know, obviously South Africa and Turkey still struggle with that, you know, fragility at the moment, and particularly Turkey at the moment. But India has dropped off that after 4 years, and now it is converging. I guess on the one hand, if you look at its growth and inflation performance, the good news is that on the growth front, it isn't converging. Its growth rate is still well ahead of developed markets. You have a big gap between DM growth rates and that Indian growth rate of 6.18% to 8% that we've been talking about just now. So you want that gap to remain high. On the other hand, the inflation convergence has happened. So you go back to the period 2010 to 2015, India's average inflation at the time was 9%. The rest of developed markets had inflation rates of 2% at the time. So you had a 7% gap. between DM and Indian inflation at the time. Now India's inflation has come down to 5.5%. Rest of the world, developed markets, is about 3%. So, you know, 2.5% difference there in terms of inflation. So a big convergence, and this is something you've seen quite a lot of emerging markets, a good relative inflation performance compared to developed markets, but particularly notable in India. And the central bank's policy stance at the moment is that it has positive real interest rates and a hawkish stance in terms of its verbal ideas and how it talks about things to the market. So it's trying to get that 5.5% down to 4%. So all kind of going in the right direction for India. I think it'll be an interesting story and one that we'll talk about a lot more as we get towards June, and we'll talk about what's going on in the bond markets as we get nearer that date too. So enjoy your Easters and catch up with you soon. Bye.